motivated by racial animus, but rather because Mr. Arbery seemed to them like a potential crime suspect. Gregory McMichael's lawyer, A.J. Balbo, told the jury that Mr. McMichael had not been out to hunt down a black person on that day, but rather to go after Mr. Arbery specifically after a police officer showed him security camera images of Mr. Arbery entering a nearby house that was under construction. Mr. Arbery had entered the house numerous times in the weeks before the shooting, including the moments before the chase began, though there is no evidence he stole or disturbed the property inside. 12 days before the shooting, Travis McMichael had also seen Mr. Arbery outside of the house and had called 911, claiming he saw Mr. Arbery reach towards his waistband, a gesture, Mr. McMichael said, that made it seem like he could have been reaching for a gun. Prosecuting hate crime cases is considered difficult because the government must prove not only that defendants harbour racist views, but that their crimes were specifically motivated by bigotry. In this case, evidence of the defendant's racism proved to be both voluminous and harsh, including numerous uses of racist epithets and racial insults. The government's case, with its video of Mr. Arbery grasping for his final breaths on the pavement and testimony that the defendants did not render aid to him, seemed to take an emotional toll on jurors, some of whom could be seen crying. Last week, one of the jurors asked court officials if counselling was available. At the end of the day, the evidence in this case will prove if Ahmed Arbery had been white, he would have gone for a jog, checked out a house under construction, and been home in time for Sunday supper, Bobby Bernstein, a Justice Department lawyer, told the jury. Instead, he went out for a jog and he ended up running for his life. Instead, he ended up bleeding to death, alone and scared, in the middle of the street. After the verdict, one defense lawyer declined to comment and a second could not be reached. Pete Theodosian, lawyer for Mr. William Bryan, said he had been optimistic about his client's chances. "We'll have to respect the decision of the jury and move on from here," he said. The verdict was an important victory for the Justice Department. Attorney General Merrick Garland said at a news conference that today's verdict makes clear that the Justice Department will continue to use every resource at its disposal to confront unlawful acts of hate and to hold accountable those who perpetrate them. The death of Ahmed Arbery was met with revulsion from both conservative and liberal lawmakers in Georgia. It prompted state legislators to significantly weaken a citizen's arrest law that one local prosecutor cited soon after the shooting to argue that the three men should not be arrested. It also prompted them to pass a state hate crime law. This month, the legislature also passed a resolution declaring Wednesday, the second anniversary of the killing, Ahmed Arbery Day. Memorial events are planned in several cities in Georgia. As the verdicts were read out in court on Tuesday morning, Mr. Arbery's parents and other family members lowered their heads, some praying. "Thank God," said Marcus Arbery Sr., Ahmed Arbery's father. The only black man on the jury, who also served as the foreman, wiped tears from his face as the verdict for each charge was read. The woman seated beside him also cried throughout Tuesday's proceedings. "Ahmed Arbery will continue to rest in peace," said Wanda Cooper Jones, Mr. Arbery's mother, "but he will now begin to rest in power."
Midstream. While the current wave of resistance in the occupied West Bank is renewing itself through continuous resistance operations against the Zionist entity and its illegal colonial settlers, the Negev Desert over the past week has joined the series of surprises. After a long period of silence, during which the occupation thought that it could simply force the Palestinian residents to evacuate their villages, the recent uprising in the Negev came along to revive the Israeli nightmare of the Saif al-Quds. A threat to the state. The discussion here is not about Israel's paranoia with Iran's nuclear project nor Hezbollah's precise missiles. Rather, what Israel views as direct threat from the people of the Palestinian desert to its actual existence as an apartheid entity. After all, Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Zionist entity, was frank when he said, "If we do not stand firm in the desert, Tel Aviv will fall." This is a quotation that the Karen Kayameth Le'Israel Jewish National Fund used as its slogan decades ago for afforestation of the Negev Desert, addressing its projects entitled Achieving Ben-Gurion's Vision, while of course linking their plans to a number of God's promises exclusively to them. The Zionist occupation referred to the Palestinians of the Negev as the Bedouin problem. Finding a solution for this problem has been since 2005 the responsibility of the Israeli National Security Council, which explicitly means that in the eyes of the occupation, these native Palestinians constitute a demographic and existential danger and an explosive substance that contains violent energy for confrontation. The Knesset even approved in 2005 the Public Lands Law, which stipulates the eviction of public lands from any people, movable property, animals, or every building based on it and everything related to it permanently. For years, this law was used as a pretext to displace Palestinians from the Negev, whether by demolishing their homes, spraying their crops and livestock with toxic chemicals, or bulldozing their crops and planting trees unfamiliar to desert environment as an alternative, as well as imposing outrageous fines on Palestinians who dare enter their own land. The events underway in the Negev are but an episode of the series of devastation that the Palestinians experience there on a daily basis. Under the protection of the Zionist police and escorted by the bulldozers, members of the Jewish National Fund storm what they refer to as the unrecognized villages, raise the lands without any prior warning in preparation for fencing them and then confiscating them for the benefit of the illegal Zionist settlement project. This has been going on for such a long time that the native Palestinians realized they had no choice but to take matters into their own hands and reclaim their rights, because the law in that forest was never on their side. After all, what was taken by force can only be restored by force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Although there are local reasons for the recent ignition of the Israeli campaign on the Negev, what this region is witnessing today is not far from the historical context established by David Ben-Gurion, since he declared that if Israel does not preserve the desert, then Tel Aviv will fall. A slogan regularly repeated by the Jewish National Fund, which had a remarkable role in establishing the Zionist entity and is working to implement this slogan in Negev with temporary settlement plans. Now, plans that are erected under the pretext of the blooming of the desert project as a cover for the displacement of native Palestinians. On the other hand, these Palestinians insist on clinging to their rights, railing with every possible tool the daily epic struggle and steadfastness. To discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Sarah Wilkinson, a human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine from a very long time. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah, to discuss the issue of the Negev. Now, the Israeli establishment with its various arms is masterful in clamping down on the people of the occupied Negev as far as 1948 and attempting to steal their land. But the past week, Zionists were actually surprised with the massive popular upheaval in the areas of Arab al-Atrash and Sa'wa, in scenes that brought back to the memory of the Intifada of the Palestinian people of 48. We're talking about the occupied territories inside of Palestine, especially during last May in the Battle of the sword of Al-Quds. How do you assess such a popular resistance by the 1948 Arabs?
I think recently what we've seen is some very, very coordinated campaigns which have mobilized people not just in Palestine but also internationally. The Save Sheikh Jarrah campaign, Save Sil, One Save Beta, they've all become quite well known, popularized. And so I think that, you know, the resistance against the ethnic cleansing, which is an ethnic cleansing of the Nakab on a massive scale, some of the groundwork had already been laid. And so the Palestinians have become much more like one society, one force against Israeli occupation, which is and less fragmented, which is something that we've probably not seen for quite a long time. So the movement has been growing for many years. But I think the Save Sheikh Jarrah movement, with activists like Mohammed Al-Kurd and Munir Al-Kurd, that has popularized it. And it has made people aware of it all across the world. And it's laid the groundwork for such resistance, I think.
Well, Sarah, it seems that activists in the occupied Negev believe that the aim of this theft is to actually prevent the expansion of the natural expansion, by the way, of the Palestinian villages, and to impose restrictions on their people to force them to migrate again to other areas in occupied Palestine, knowing that the Israeli entity, since after the 1948 Nakba, had adopted the method of afforestation in the abandoned villages to practically just to obliterate Palestinian monuments, Palestinian history from those villages. We see a lot of images and photos of old houses eaten up by Mother Nature because of this attempted afforestation by the Zionist entity. So it's a matter of actual survival for these Palestinians versus an illegal expansion of the Zionist settlement in Negev. In the case Israel decides to ups the ante against the Bedouins, Sarah, will there be coordinated resistance similar to what we saw last May?
Well, this is it. Whether the Palestinians can maintain or sustain this amount of resistance, this is a huge area we're talking about. It's like 3.3 million acres, if I'm right. I don't know what that is in dunams, but it's a massive area. So, and the attempt from the Zionists to take over the Nakab region, that's been going on for decades, probably since 1948. So it's been renewed. With the JNF funding, renewed funding, actually experimental weaponry as well is being used against them. So it's been renewed under the guise of this forestation, urbanization, the new Tel Aviv city, if you like, that's going to be built over the top of these ethnically cleansed Bedouin villages, of which 70 villages, I think, are under threat, or around 70 villages. So this plan has been going on for decades, but what the Israelis have done is renewed it under the pretext of forestation. Well, we're quite aware that, during 1948, over 500 villages were ethnically cleansed. They were wiped off the map, and forestation was one of the ways that they buried these ethnically cleansed villages with non-indigenous trees to make the new settlers more welcome, or, they found the trees more welcoming. Of course, that caused forest fires, which in turn, I think the sinister part of the plot was probably the Israelis don't mind about the forest fires because it finished off the villages and prevents them from returning home. So this plan has been going on for a long time, but it's been revised to look like something that politicians are more likely to want to invest in. It's like a greenwashing. But we must never forget this is a massive ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. And the Israelis aren't just going to turn around because there is some resistance. What it will do is will continue an onslaught, an invasion of the Nakab until it gets what it wants. And yes, the idea is to force 70 or 90,000 Bedouin into small areas near the nuclear reactor, the Dimona reactor, where the ground is toxic.
Because so they want to move the people, they want to move the native Palestinians closer to Dimona?
Yeah, I think there's three areas. I think Beersheba is one. I forget one, but the other one is Dimona. But we know that that 55-year-old nuclear reactor has been leaking. The Israelis have been handing out, they've actually been distributing anti-radiation pills to the Israelis who live and work there. So they know the area isn't safe. So you move 70 communities into these 27,000 acres, bearing in mind 3.3 million acres is where they come from, into a tiny 27,000 acre region that is not safe for subsistence farming. What you're doing is not just ethnically cleansing them by making them migrate, you're actually shortening their life expectancy. So actually it's a double ethnic cleansing. I think it's quite sinister to be moving subsistence farmers that work on the land, that have sheep, livestock, cattle, into areas that are not safe to farm in.
Well, that definitely will open up a lot of doors to the actual reason that would push Tel Aviv to do this to the Palestinians, who already know as an occupation. This is something that they have been doing for the past century, but specifically with the Bedouin crisis, moving them closer to such a very high risky area, which kind of seems like they're using them as human shields to protect, basically, whatever they are hiding in that area. But it's been a pleasure having you on, Sarah Wilkinson, human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine. I'm sorry that we are out of time, but I promise that we will have you more to talk about this. Sadly, we need to talk more about this as much as we can. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian-Syrian new economic ties.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
While Syrian President Bashar Assad and Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi discussed last week bilateral relations, especially at the economic level. Now, President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that achieve the common strategic benefit of Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. The joint discussions also dealt with ways to expand bilateral work in the public and private sectors and encourage joint investments with the aim of giving a new drive to trade and economic ties. For his part, Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian population in the face of the horrific war, the terrorist war that they have been facing, and Iran's keenness to expand cooperation between the two countries in all fields that serve the interests of the two friendly peoples. Iran and Syria to expand trade ties in this following report.
Iranian Minister of Transport and Urban Development Rostam Ghazemi arrived in Syria last week, heading a high-level economic and political delegation to discuss ways to develop economic cooperation between the two countries. Upon his arrival at Damascus Airport, where he was received by Syrian Economy Minister Mohammad Samer al-Khalil and Iranian Ambassador to Syria Mahdi Subhani, Minister Ghazemi stressed the determination of Tehran and Damascus to achieve real economic and trade partnership. For his part, the Syrian Minister of Economy affirmed that his country seeks comprehensive cooperation with Iran, hoping the meeting will lead to good consensus in order to reach full economic and trade partnership between the two countries. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Iranian Minister of Transportation Rostam Ghazemi discussed bilateral economic relations. President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that would achieve the common strategic benefit for Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian people in the face of the war against terrorism and American imperialism. Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates Faisal Maqdad and Iranian Minister Qasemi also met and discussed issues of common interest between the two countries, stressing the need to upgrade economic relations between them to keep pace with the level of development of joint political relations. Iran and Syria had also signed 4 documents to boost cooperation in the fields of trade and industry during a visit of an Iranian delegation headed by the country's industry minister to Damascus last month. The documents were inked at the end of the two countries' joint economic and industrial committee meetings, which were held in the Syrian capital, Damascus. However, last week's important bilateral economic talks came simultaneously as Syria officially joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. unilateral punitive measures. Damascus's participation was initiated during a ceremony last Tuesday through the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding by Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority Chair Fadil Khalil and Chinese Ambassador to Syria Feng Biao. The initiative gets its name from the ancient Silk Road that once ran through Asia, with West Asia serving as a crossroads to Africa and Europe. The Iranian and Chinese trade pact signed last week with Syria will act as defining goals and guides to all three countries' projects, which will for sure deepen the working cooperation between them and strengthen the harmonization between Iran, Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative and the policies of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, while also strengthening Iranian and Chinese participation in the economic reconstruction of Syria.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Sara Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Sara. Now, an Iranian delegation headed by Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Qasemi visited the Syrian capital last week and met with Syrian President Bashar Assad and a number of government ministers and discussed with them the various commercial, industrial, and banking sectors. How do you assess the importance of such economic ties between Iran and Syria at such a difficult time?
Well, let me start by saying that Iran did not only stand by Syria politically and militarily, but also stood by Syria economically over the last decade. This was manifested in two ways. The first is through the delivery of various commodities, oil derivatives, production requirements, and many other essentials to Syria. The second relates to the renewed prospects that were evident in the joint free trade zone between the two countries and the credit line, which was worth nearly $2 billion. Unfortunately, however, the level of economic relations has not yet reached the level of political and military relations between both states. In this context, we saw Minister Qasemi's vital visit to Damascus, where a number of agreements and understandings were signed. What is new in Minister Qasemi's visit to Damascus, other than Qasemi's status as head of the Syrian-Iranian Joint Economic Committee, but also his status as Minister of Transportation and Urban Development in Iran? This is a new indication of the stage that the two countries will enter together to mark the start of the reconstruction phase in Syria after more than a decade of war. Let me pass on to you this piece of information that has not yet been announced. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi will be visiting Damascus in less than a month. Of course, what will be evaluated in this upcoming visit is the results of Minister Qasemi's visit and also to raise the level of economic relations between the two countries.
That sounds very, very interesting, Ms. Sarah. Well, Minister Qasemi, who heads, just as you said, the Iranian side of the Iranian-Syrian Joint Economic Committee, indicated in a statement after the conclusion of his working visit to Syria that a consensus was reached to work on establishing, quote, a joint bank and opening branches of existing local banks in both countries, in addition to joint free trade zones in both countries. Now, this is a crystal clear challenge to the U.S.'s illegal Caesar's Law that was meant to actually besiege Syria financially. How do you think the Americans will react to such a new financial deal between Syria and Iran?
Let me just make 2 points clear. The idea of the Syrian-Iranian joint bank is not a new idea, but it was established in 2009 or 2010. That is actually obtained a license to operate in Syria under the name of Bank of Hope. But kickstarting that bank was not successful at the time for various reasons, but what matters today is that it has been revived. This idea is to reactivate this bank again. You asked me about the American reaction to these economic ties. Certainly, the United States will not be satisfied or pleased with these relations. But regardless of this, Iran has always succeeded in evading illegal American sanctions. Iran succeeded in delivering all derivatives to Syria and broke the equation of unilateral punitive measures by delivering aid to Venezuela and to Lebanon as well. We even witnessed the war that almost erupted in the Arabian Sea after the United States of America tried to block one of the ships transporting Iranian oil derivatives. And you know very well that today there are negotiations underway in Vienna. If the results of these talks are positive, it is a good thing. And if not, I think that there are escalatory steps that Iran will take to break the siege, and the financial and banking sector is not immune to these steps. I'm referring here specifically to the Syrian-Iranian joint bank, which will be activated soon.
Well, Ms. Sarah, Minister Kazemi said something very interesting during his visit concerning transportation in various sectors being one of the most important requirements for both countries' economic development. So the road the U.S. waged war against Syria to prevent from opening between regional countries, especially Iran, Iraq, and Syria, will officially be opened soon. Some might say Syria paid a heavy price for this road. Do you agree?
Of course, Syria paid a heavy price for this road and this war in general. Syria, as you may know, was a strong country in West Asia. It has moved from being a country that is self-sufficient and food-sufficient with zero foreign debts to a country that, unfortunately, is experiencing suffocating economic and social crises. But for now, what is most important is that the blood of the martyrs should not be wasted, the blood of the martyrs who fell in this war. An important issue you touch upon is construction and infrastructure project that will link the three countries, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, together. This project will bring about very important economic and political results for all three states and will provide jobs for many citizens. This project will not only transport goods between the three countries, but will also transport citizens. For instance, goods used to take 2 months to reach from Iran to Syria. Today, thanks to this project, if it is successfully implemented, goods will only take a few days to reach Syria. The project's starting point will be the Iranian-Iraqi border. It will stretch to reach Al-Qa'im, then to Al-Bukamal, and then to Homs, and to end off at two destinations, the Syrian capital Damascus and Latakia on the Syrian coast. Certainly, this project will have very important economic and political results. Also, this project will be linked to other networks in Central Asia, and in turn, these networks will be linked to other networks in Russia and China.
Well, Ms. Sarah, exactly what you said is very important because officially Syria has joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. sanctions, which I don't like to call sanctions. They are unilateral punitive measures by the United States of America against Syria in hopes of securing a lifeline for lucrative investment in a country that is still ravaged by more than a decade of global war against it. Now, Damascus participation happened during the same week which it's actually signed the new deals with Iran. It did the signatory with the Chinese ambassador in Syria, Mr. Feng Biao, opening up to Iran and to China in the same week. Look, I can hear Americans screaming because of this, but how do you think this step will benefit Syria in the upcoming future?
Of course, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt, One Road Initiative, is the largest initiative of the century. And since the planning of this initiative, Syria was destined to be an essential component of it, but the war effectively delayed its accession to this initiative. You also remember that the Chinese foreign minister was in Damascus in the 7th month of the last year, and he signed that at that time this agreement to return this year to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority and the Chinese side, authorizing Syria's entry into this initiative, which includes several economic and social aspects like health, education, and most important of all is the aspect of reconstruction. We may not see its results tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but we will certainly see them soon. You know, the direction of the Syrian government today is to head east. Unfortunately, we have previously experienced failed projects with the European Union, which used our economy to blackmail us in politics and impose unjust unilateral sanctions. This is a fundamental reason for what we Syrians are experiencing today from several stifling living and economic crises. Meanwhile, China has proved in the past 10 years that it is an economic superpower that has been rising tremendously and has also proven that it is a trustworthy partner. I stress here on the word partner because it has established a new concept in international relations, which is partnership between great powers and other countries instead of the concept of hegemony.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Sarah Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent economic ties between Iran, Syria, and China, for that matter. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Dream. Bye-bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Flying is one of the most carbon-intensive activities people can undertake, and ghost flights have angered those campaigning for action on the climate crisis. We now present you an article written jointly by Damien Carrington and John Vidal. The piece is titled, "Until Airlines Tackle the Scourge of Ghost Flights, Britain will never reach net zero." According to newly revealed official figures, almost 15,000 ghost flights have departed from the United Kingdom. The ghost flights, defined as those with no passengers or less than 10% of passenger capacity, operated from all 32 airports listed in the data. Heathrow Airport was top, with 4,910 ghost flights between March of 2020 and September of 2021. Manchester Airport and Gatwick Airport were the next highest. There were an average of 760 ghost flights a month over the period, although the data covered only international departure and not domestic flights. Flying is one of the most carbon-intensive activities people can undertake, and ghost flights have angered those campaigning for action on the climate crisis. The German airline Lufthansa recently warned it would have to fly 18,000 unnecessary flights by March in order to keep its landing slots at airports. Under current rules, airlines lose their valuable slots if they are not sufficiently used. However, during the pandemic hit period covered by the new UK data, The rules that had required 80% of slots to be used were completely suspended. Airlines did not have to operate flights to retain the slots, but nonetheless flew 14,472 ghost flights. The UK Aviation Minister, Robert Quartz, who produced the data in response to a parliamentary question, said flights may operate with a low number of passengers for a range of reasons. He added, since the onset of the pandemic, the government has provided alleviation from the normal slot regulations. This means that airlines have not been required to operate empty or almost empty flights solely to retain their historic slot rights. The Labour MP, Alex Sobel, who asked the question and is chair of the Net Zero All-Party Parliamentary Group, said, to really tackle the climate emergency, we need to ensure that our aviation sector is as efficient as it can be with its carbon output. Anna Hughes at Flight Free UK, and whose parliamentary petition on the issue now has 11,000 signatures, said, at a time of climate emergency, we need to be drastically reducing our use of fossil fuel, not burning it in empty planes. Slot rules were partially restored in October of 2021, requiring 50% usage, and this will rise to 70% at the end of March. Anna Hughes said, if more than 14,000 empty flights took off from UK airports when there was no requirement to retain landing slots, how many more will have taken off since? Of course, all flights harm the climate, which is why we also campaign for a reduction in demand, a tax on aviation fuel, and more affordable trains. But preventing planes from flying empty should be an easy win for policymakers and the climate. Tim Johnson at the Aviation Environment Federation said, information on ghost flights is hidden from public view, with airlines avoiding scrutiny by claiming the data is proprietary. No doubt airlines fear reputational damage, but the public and consumers should be informed. It shouldn't take a parliamentary question to expose the scale of this wasteful practice. Tim Johnson said, the number of flights may be small in comparison to the overall total, but the effects on our climate add up when you consider the average short-haul flight emits between 13 and 20 tonnes of carbon dioxide. The Guardian asked the Department of Transport for data on ghost flights in January, but was told the Department for Transport did not hold this data. The Civil Aviation Authority, which provided the new data to the government, refused the Freedom of Information request from The Guardian, saying it did not have the consent of the airlines to release the information. Slot rules are monitored and enforced by a company called Airport Coordination Limited, but it told The Guardian passenger numbers on flights could come only from the airlines themselves. British Airways and Virgin Atlantic told The Guardian, they did not operate ghost flights to retain slots, but declined to provide data on the occupancy of their flights. A spokesperson for Virgin Atlantic said COVID-19 had an unprecedented impact on customer demand, with wide-ranging global restrictions that limited international travel. For 3 months during 2020, Virgin Atlantic did not operate any passenger flights. Any lower occupancy flights that operated outside of this window were not ghost flights. They supported the global movement of people, including returning foreign citizens and repatriated UK citizens. Both airlines said the increase in the required slot usage to 70%, the highest in the world, would lead to low occupancy flights. Louis Gallego, the chief executive at IAG, British Airways' parent company, said this decision would force airlines to operate flights with low load factors, which will generate unnecessary carbon dioxide emissions. This is bad for the environment and detrimental to aviation's efforts to tackle climate change. Ryanair and EasyJet did not respond to requests for comment. Tim Johnson said the slot system was unsustainable and outdated and that reform was needed. He added, "Slots at congested airports can exchange hands for millions of pounds each, so there are very strong incentives for airlines to keep using them, even when passengers' demand is very low. The government should rule out airport expansion and instead focus on slot reform and other efficiency improvements." Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The occasion of International Mother Language Day, February the 21st, warrants a look at one of the most beautiful and important languages, Persian or Farsi. As this language attracts a lot of the wrong kind of attention as well as appreciation by some of the world's greatest poets, among them Goethe, the great German poet, who drew on Persian verse for his works. The wrong kind of attention, on the other hand, has historically come from ill-wishers trying to divide and rule this strategically located rich land, which connects the Indian subcontinent to Europe and is strategically placed on the Silk Routes. A latest attempt at mischief, however, has arisen closer to home under the guise of the hashtag ManoFarsi, or Me and Persian.
What can be said of Persian? What has been said of it? Persian is sugar. Persian is the language of poetry and culture. It has been in India. And it's been the language of science. Most importantly here, it's a common Iranian language, unifying and uniting Iranian peoples. But now people outside are telling us to bin the language, or at best, lock it up. Sounds crazy, I know. But many a wise man has said much on the issue, as it's nothing new. So to hear some of what's said, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today.
Hashtag ManoFarsi claims to highlight language discrimination in Iran. Mohsen Rasuli, known as an anti-racism activist, said, "We want to raise awareness about the suffering of living in a monolingual system within a multilingual society." Sounds to me like the society is multilingual. So the many languages and dialects are alive, so they haven't been crushed, although Iran is a sovereign state and needs a state language, which it has. Mr. Rahimi, PhD, goes further in saying why Persian was no adversary to those local languages and dialects. He is on the scientific board of the Art and Literature Cultural Center. He says standard modern Persian has in fact borrowed from them in growing richer.
It's in the nature of the Farsi language and Farsi speakers throughout history that they don't consider the language a superior one. They don't consider a poem in another language as inferior or primitive compared to Farsi. That's what I mean when I say they're all part of a larger corpus. The more we focus on strengthening them, the main corpus gets stronger. It won't be weaker. Farsi isn't harmed if Kurdish poetry is strengthened.
If France and Germany need an official state language or lingua franca, so does Iran, a land united by a Persian king 2,500 years ago. And indeed, this lingua franca Persian has not destroyed its sister languages and dialects under its far-reaching shade. They have existed all along, but speakers of those languages have chosen Persian to recite poetry in, therefore making Persian their own. So why would they give it up together with their Iranian nationality and claim on the whole of Iran by separating from the mainland and adopting their own provincial language or dialect as their lingua franca in their new country, which would actually be no more than a province? Because that is the course of action suggested by the ManuFarsi hashtag and the like.
First of all, separation or division into united or federal states doesn't mean scrapping a common language facilitating relations. Look at America or Germany. Secondly, why divide the country now that the whole world is becoming one? Just because Saudi Arabia or Israel think it's a good idea?
Mr. Simiari is a media man who's delved into all controversial matters in detail. Leaving office and field work behind, he stepped into our studios to share his insight on today's issue.
It's interesting to know that, for example, in France, since 2018, all dialects other than the standard language are banned. Why aren't the enemies targeting that? Following Brexit, 17 British, 38 German and 2 Italian dialects were totally banned there. This shows that the issue of identity and a shared language is pretty significant. Farsi is the standard language here, but as you know, Kurdish and Turkish are being taught in our schools. The parents speak their local language to their children at home. We have never run into any problems in that regard. But the enemy invests energy on such issues because it wants to target our culture.
The said hashtag went round like hotcakes at the hands of Persian language UK-based news channels such as Iran International. That's a channel funded via a secret offshore entity and a company whose director is a businessman from Iran's regional rival Saudi Arabia. And he has close links to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Not to bash Saudi alone, Turkey has been working on its pan-Turkism aspirations. Israel has said the Middle East should be split down into small states, and the West won't forget the mantra Britain went by, divide and rule, that is, given their interest in Iran. Mr. Ghadiri Abiyane is a former ambassador who gives us his time now and again. He made a trek to Press TV studios to now talk on Farsi and the weight it is to bear, as well as the pleasure.
The colonist policy in dealing with Muslim nations and third world countries in general is that of divide and conquer. They've devised a whole slew of plans for that too. Take Africa, for example. Taking a look at the map of the continent, you'll see thousands of kilometers of straight border lines. That obviously hasn't been natural, they're hand-drawn. But somewhere along the borders, you'll see the lines moved a little. What is that? It's where they've divided an ethnic community into two parts to turn that into a dispute for both countries. Or they may have left some parts of the borders open, so both sides have territorial claims on the land and are in constant opposition to each other. Or they may have sowed religious discord among the people, calling one group Shia and the other Sunni. They've even created divisions among Shia Muslims. This is while all those people believe in Islam. They've started ethnic disputes and fomented racist ideas.
Not to make a big thing of what sounds like what must have just been a teenage schoolgirl complex, but Sebel Soleimani, co-founder of the End of Monolingualism campaign, complained to Iran Wire about having been in a class of 35 non-Persian speakers in first grade in Iran. The complaint is, these 35 non-Persian speakers had to study in Persian. Well, if in Ardabil, where she spent her early life, of course the whole class will have learned their first few words at home in Azeri Turkish, as that is free to talk informally, is taught at school in Azerbaijan province alongside Farsi, and is broadcast in on local TV stations. Now, who wouldn't want their child to study in the state language at school? Apparently, Soleimani, whom I quote as saying, "The Iranian education system is not designed for language learning. The system is geared toward high literacy, assuming that all children know Persian. About 50% have no idea." Han, that's why they go to school, to learn. I might add, Soleimani, who had such trouble learning Persian or studying in Persian at school, put herself through learning English to mastery. As PhD student of sociology at George Mason University, Virginia, USA.
I realized something interesting when I examined the hashtag that became trending. At first, the hashtag was used only 8 times. But immediately after Al Arabiya Farsi and Saudi Arabia's Iran International carried out operational work on it, the hashtag was used and retweeted nearly 43,000 times on social media platforms. This showed that a party was taking initiative and driving a movement. It was very interesting. Our findings showed that the cyber movement was being directed from Saudi Arabia and the occupied territories that were being helped by separatists and counter-revolution groups. They were creating an atmosphere we know as psychological warfare, which is part of the hybrid warfare the leader of the Islamic Revolution mentioned in his latest remarks.
Now another tiny point. Soleimani grew up in Parsabad in Azerbaijan. Parsabad meaning a land constructed by Persians or inhabited by Persians. That's one example to show the area never started out as Azeri Turkish-speaking to begin with. Azer or Azar actually means fire in Persian, indicating a Zoroastrian past rather than Turkish.
A person living in Samarkand cannot say that Farsi is an international language that can be used to communicate with someone in Tehran. That person has a share in the creation and possession of this language. That's the case for a person living in Tabriz. Qatran Tabrizi wrote poems in the city not too further in time than Rudaki. The land where Nizami Ganjavi was born has a share too. When we say we have a Farsi language that can rise in the world and have something to say among other languages, is because of these masterpieces.
As for statistics, apart from a Persian past, 53% of Iranians speak Persian as a main language. That's to say, over half of Iranians say their early words in Persian, in their mother tongue. The 2001 Iranian census put the figure of Iranians born to the Persian language at 68%. That figure included distinctive dialects such as Lori. Well, a dialect can be considered a branch of the main language. But never mind that. There's no telling any two given Lori or Kurdish villages will understand one another's dialect or language variation. So what now? Even if just for argument's sake enemies manage to divide Iran, the many dialects among each tribe and ethnicity will be a problem. They will still have to select one version of their mother tongue, say Kurdish, as their official language. And we'll be back to a tighter version of monolingualism with the exclusion of any language common between them. In other words, omitting Persian is just an excuse to weaken Iran at its core.
We belong to a historical identity that is above and beyond that of the American, Saudi, and the Israeli enemies. They know that they can't confront a nation that has such a strong cultural and civilizational background. But they can put cracks on its body and gradually make it spread. That is what they are investing in.
In keeping with divide-and-conquer policy, they're focusing on the linguistic division of the people. Why shouldn't every ethnic group speak its own language, Farsi? Why are they trying to teach English and French to every single person? Is it because they want Iranians to forget their own language and learn theirs instead? We don't take issue with learning a foreign language, but they keep insisting on pushing Farsi to the side.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Time for a quick diversion to hear from other media outlets of ancient evidence of Persian language and literature and its reach, as well as comments on its poets and their contributions.
Here's how our sites of choice have put it in words. The Tehran Times reveals rock-carved inscription stairs discovered in southern Iranian plain. Cultural heritage personnel, during their routine inspections, have discovered a rock-carved inscription and some rock-hewn stairs in Marvdasht Plain. Situated in Fars province, the southern Iranian plain is home to the UNESCO-registered sites of Persepolis and Pasargad, as well as tens of other magnificent structures. The inscription, measuring 100 by 75 centimeters, bears Nastaliq scripts, which is the predominant style of Persian calligraphy during the 15th and 16th centuries. Persian language, also called Farsi, is a member of the Iranian branch of the Indo-Iranian language family. That's a part of Indo-European, actually. Old Persian, spoken until approximately the 3rd century BC, is attested to by numerous inscriptions written in cuneiform, most notable of which is the great monument of Darius I at Bisatun, western Iran. Newsweek quotes some praise of Ferdowsi while bringing news of entertainment. Bulgarian director Elena Panayotova praises Ferdowsi's efforts to maintain the Persian language. The Bulgarian stage director has praised the efforts made by Persian poet Ferdowsi over a millennium ago to protect the Persian language against foreign language threats. She came to Tehran to stage her latest production, Shahnameh, a story of Zal, based on a story from Ferdowsi's magnum opus, the Shahnameh, or Book of Kings, at the 40th Fajr International Theatre Festival. We know that the Shahnameh has produced abundant, attractive literature for humanity, she said in a press release published by the organizers of the 2022 Fajr Theatre Festival. I have studied about Ferdowsi's life, death, and his masterpiece, and gradually came to understand that it was his Shahnameh that managed to maintain the Persian language, and that the Persian language would have been ruined if the masterpiece had not been created, she noted. Greater Kashmir has something on preserving Persian heritage. Preserving Persian epigraphic heritage, it reads. With the establishment of the Muslim Sultanate in Kashmir in the late 14th century, the Sanskrit language and Sharda alphabet were also taken over by Persian and Arabic alphabets. The tradition of Sharda epigraphic culture also declined considerably and gave way to Persian and Arabic inscriptions. The earliest Persian and Arabic inscriptions are seen on tombstones and walls in the olden graveyards, khanqahs, and mosques of Kashmir. The number of such inscriptions are documented in a book titled Kashmir Inscriptions of Kashmir, which was published in the year 2013 by Gulshan Books, Srinagar. That'll be it for the news section, but do stay tuned for the rest of our narration. The said hashtag circulators and promoters say they want to see an acceptance of pluralism and of ethnic, linguistic, religious, and gender diversity. What it looks like their hashtag would have each new provincial country teaching its own mother tongue or dialect as its lingua franca, leaving it truly monolingual without the treasure that is Persian. The hashtag promoters, however, do complain about monolingualism enforced in Iran, saying that even in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, under Article 15, the teaching of literature in one's mother tongue is explicitly emphasized. Mother tongue meaning their local language or dialect. I say, so what now? They're complaining about the Constitution calling for and enforcing what they do want? Two articles of Iran's Constitution cover the status of ethnic minorities. Chapter 2, Article 15 reads, "The official language and script of Iran, the lingua franca of its people, is Persian. Official documents, correspondence and texts, as well as textbooks, must be in this language and script. However, the use of regional and tribal languages in the press and mass media, as well as for teaching of their literature in schools, is allowed in addition to Persian.